Good morning, everybody. Good morning, test, test. Test. Hold your ears until I get it just right. Okay, that's probably going to work just fine. All right, so this is Bio 241. Welcome to class. And it is September 3rd. And we're proceeding through the class pretty well. We're going to start chapter 6 today. If we look at the schedule, today's the 3rd, we should finish up chemistry, so if anybody has any questions on chemistry, we should definitely address them. Maybe we'll do that flash quiz one more time, maybe do a pH calculation, something like that. All right, and then we're going to move into interactions between cells and their environment in a little bit. So your first exam, so if today's the 3rd, your first exam is 2.5 weeks away. 2.5 weeks away, right? And you all know the chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. And how are you going to prepare for that lecture exam? The study guide, that's right. Make sure you print out that study guide. There might be some exam figures in there. And there might be some online questions that I'd like. There are probably end of chapter questions that I'd like. Maybe there's even questions in the middle of the chapter that I like. They should all be in the study guide. All right, so for fun, how about if we do that chemistry flash quiz? First thing. All right, and I'm getting the lights just right. How's that? Does that work for everybody? Pretty much. Let me get the microphone back working again. All right, so where's the flash quiz? Here's the flash quiz, and it's on monitor 2, so I can go 2 to 2 like that. And then we're going to proceed. All right, so. Maybe this arrow. No, not that arrow. Okay. Maybe this arrow. Yeah. Okay, that works. So here we have a chemical compound. Oh, you can't see it. That would be a really good test. Maybe in 50 years we can do that. Okay, so that's why it's so dark up here. All right, so here is a chemical compound. And let's analyze this chemical compound in just a second. It's appearing, warming up, lights are flashing. All right, well, as we get started, don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. Okay, that is going around. Who's got the sign-in sheet right now? Oh, it's way in the back of the room. So, if it has passed you by, make sure you sign it before you leave class today. All right, so here are the screens turning on. So, here we have what kind of group is this right here? Phosphate group, as a matter of fact. And what's a lot better way of talking about this phosphate? You could say phosphate group, but you would want to call it a P plus a little I underneath, subscript I. That's how you would write it down, and that just stands for inorganic phosphate. Inorganic phosphate, right? A PO4 group is an inorganic phosphate, and this is the actual chemical formula for it. All right, and then what does this look like over here? A sugar molecule, and how many carbons are in the sugar molecule? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is a pentose, right? Most of the sugars that we're going to be looking at are hexoses or have 6 carbons, but this one just so happens to have 5. This is a very important building block for something. And then the third piece of this molecule is over here. And probably you should know generally what this is, but you don't have to tell me the specific name, but generally this is an organic base, right? A base. So you have an inorganic phosphate, a pentose sugar, and as a matter of fact, this is ribose with an organic base. This is a building block. Who can tell me what this is a building block for? Nucleotides, and in particular, there's 2 kinds. There's deoxyribonucleotides and ribonucleotides, and which one is this a building block for? Ribonucleotides, or RNA. All right, so here is a ribonucleotide. Right, ribonucleotide when you see this, because indeed there is an oxygen in this position right there. All right, then here is a rest station. What is the functional group that we see here? Sulfhydryl group. That's a sulfhydryl group. And then what group is this? Amino group. You should be really familiar with these things right now. Carboxyl group. All right. And these functional groups change. Well, the structure is changing, so the function, the chemistry changes when we change those functional groups on a hydrocarbon backbone. What is this thing right here? Say the right term. Inorganic phosphate. Maybe your book says phosphate, but probably you should know this is inorganic phosphate because it's not just a phosphorus atom. And then we have a 6-carbon sugar. This is a monosaccharide. Probably if you say monosaccharide, that's great. You don't have to tell me which one it is, but know it's a monosaccharide. And it is a building block for what? It is a monosaccharide. It is a carbohydrate. It is a carbohydrate. And that monosaccharide is a building block for disaccharides, polysaccharides, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you have a couple monosaccharides to make a disaccharide out of it, what kind of chemical reaction does your body use? A dehydration synthesis reaction, a dehydration synthesis, all right? Well, if you want monosaccharides from a disaccharide, what kind of chemical reaction should you use? Not you should use, but what does your body use? A hydrolysis reaction. Okay, so besides the sugar molecules, there's another important molecule that participates in that chemical reaction, and that is? What molecule participates in those reactions? A water molecule, right? So for hydrolysis, a water molecule is split, and for a dehydration synthesis, a water molecule is formed. All right, so be aware of that. What do we got here? A fatty acid, and in particular, what kind of fatty acid? A saturated fatty acid. So here is the carboxyl group, which means the acidic part of this compound. And here is a very long hydrocarbon chain, and this right here is hydrophilic or hydrophobic, this end of the molecule. Hydrophobic, that's right, because carbon with hydrogen makes a nonpolar covalent bond. What kind of atoms, when they bind with hydrogen, make a polar covalent bond? Oxygen, I like that. Phosphorus, nitrogen, and don't forget sulfur as well. Okay. All right, then, here we have, what is this? What's the overall process taking place here if we look at this arrow? A dehydration synthesis reaction, and what is being synthesized? If you were going to, oh yeah, water is being synthesized, I like that. But if you're going to label this column right here, what would you label this molecule? Triglyceride. Yeah, so looking at this arrow, this is a triglyceride formation reaction. And what are the building blocks of a triglyceride? 1, 2, 3 fatty acids and a glycerol. So hopefully you can see this molecule as being a glycerol molecule. And then if you memorize that, then you know how many carbons are in glycerol. There are 3. That's right. So how could you make glycerol from a glucose? By chopping a glucose in half, right? And then you're going to get 3 carbon molecules. All right, so we got the fatty acids, dehydration synthesis reaction. If we go the reverse way, what kind of reaction would your body use? Hydrolysis reaction, fantastic, okay. All right, what do we got here? Another monosaccharide, and monosaccharides can form this ring structure if it's a simple sugar. And this is a pretty important diagram. What is that structure we're looking at? It is a micelle. And the building block of a micelle is what kind of compound? A phospholipid, that's right. So here is the phosphate end of the molecule. Here are the two hydrophobic fatty acid chains that are sticking to the center of this micelle. And these hydrophobic chains right here do experience an attraction. And we can consider that a bond. What kind of attraction? There's a name for this attraction. When hydrophobic groups attract each other, and it's a force. What kind of force is it? Yeah, it's a van der Waals force. And that force is what? Strong, weak, medium, or really weak? Really weak. This is the weakest kind of force that we're going to work with in this class. And you can even consider it a bond. Super, super weak bond. Okay. And so what can you tell me about this head group right here? Some physical chemistry properties of this phosphate head group. Okay, it is hydrophilic. I like that because here I see some water molecules. So that means that it has some polarity to it. There's some charges, and so it can form hydration shells. All right, so again, one more time, tell me, what's the nature of the inside of this micelle? Is it polar or nonpolar? It is nonpolar. So what kind of compounds would be able to dissolve on the inside of this micelle? Polar compounds or nonpolar compounds? Only nonpolar compounds can dissolve in this area, because if they're polar compounds, they would never leave the water to get to the inside. They couldn't get in there. Okay. All right, so that's going to be important in a second. What kind of compounds do these look like? Steroids, right? This is cholesterol, and then down over here we have various hormones. You don't have to be able to identify which one, but maybe you will notice that there are very small changes in substituting different functional groups on this backbone molecule, and that drastically changes the function, right? Can changes from a male sex steroid to a female sex steroid with just a very minor modification. All right, so here is, tell me this. This is another fatty acid, but different than the first one because this one is an unsaturated fatty acid. Nice. And here you're familiar with this. This is an amino acid. That's right. And remember, this functional group right here can have a number of different kind of substitutions. We could put an acidic moiety here, basic moiety, a hydrophobic moiety, or a hydrophilic one that forms maybe an ion, all different kinds of things. And there are 20 common amino acids in your body, so that means that there are 20 different kinds of substitutions that are commonly made on this alpha carbon. And in this class, you don't have to know all the names of the different amino acids and what their shape is and what their chemical properties is, but you should know that the 20 amino acids are different from each other because of what is substituted in this position on this amino acid. What do we got here? Phospholipid, that's right. So you should be familiar with this chemical structure. I might put that on an exam. I might put this on the exam. So this is easy to see as a phospholipid, but if I give you this chemical formula or this diagram with this chemical formula, could you recognize this as a phospholipid? Because what do we have? What's the backbone here? Glycerol. And I see two fatty acids in position one and two, and in the third position, we have this specially modified phosphate group, right, which gives us this polar head group. You don't have to know the name of this thing right here, but it's a specially modified inorganic phosphate group that even has another nitrogen, which makes it even more polar. All right, so here is an example of a lipid that can dissolve in water, or at least part of it, right, if it's modified with this form right here. So that is interesting, phospholipid. Here we have something that looks like a fatty acid, but it's bent, right? And there's some covalent bonds. After it's bent, these are important hormones. These are prostaglandins. All right, so what's the building block of a prostaglandin? Fatty acids, yeah, fatty acids, building block of prostaglandins. What kind of structure do we see right here? Okay. I see secondary structure of a protein, right? And in particular, what's the name of this coil right here? Alpha helix, right? So alpha helix is secondary structure. What's the building block of an alpha helix? The primary structure, which is just the amino acid sequence. Remember, there's 20 different kinds of amino acids that can be put in different locations in this alpha helix. All right, and then here's a nice compound. We got inorganic phosphate, ribose sugar, organic base, but now is this a ribose sugar you see right here? It's really close, but not quite. This is a deoxyribose, right, because we're missing the oxygen, and it's a nucleotide, so what kind of nucleotide is this? A deoxyribonucleotide. Okay. And this is a building block of DNA, not RNA, but DNA. All right, so if this is really mysterious to you, maybe you have to raise your hand and ask a question, and maybe I could help you see what's going on here. All right? Do I see any questions? Not so far.
Well, I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
Is it on Blackboard, and where can we find it?
These things are just in your... Oh, yes.
I will show you after I'm done.
Okay.
Okay, but make sure you remind me. Okay, so I have a video of this, and the video, you know, it's just a digital video, so you can stop it, you can pause it, and random access, you can hop from one place to another, and I'll show that to you. It's in, I believe, exam study guides, and for exam number one. All right. And functional group here, hydroxyl group. This is a glycerol molecule. How many carbons do you see? How many oxygens do you see? And how many hydrogens do you see? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's right. Somebody knew that already. That's fantastic. Or maybe you have like a photographic memory and can count those things just by looking at it for half a second. I don't know. Okay. All right. What do we got here? A carbonyl group. Carbonyl group. And here is a ribonucleotide, right? A ribonucleotide. All right, so here's something fun to do. After you kind of are familiar with those slides, right, pick up the pace a little bit and just train your mind to recognize these things in an instant, right? So I'm going to just show you these things very quickly, like this right here. What was that? Sulfhydro group. And this is a amino group. And here is a carboxyl group, inorganic phosphate group, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation, right? But that concept you should link up with a whole bunch of other concepts, like what the building block is and all that kind of stuff, and go in the reverse direction as well. As a matter of fact, tell me what reaction is used to synthesize a triglyceride. Dehydration synthesis, what's that? Monosaccharide, micelle, steroids, unsaturated fatty acids, unsaturated fatty acid, amino acid, phospholipid, prostaglandin, alpha helix, which is what kind of structure of a protein? Secondary structure, and is a building block of? Alpha helix is a building block of, I wouldn't say primary structure, is tertiary structure. Primary structure is a building block of alpha helix, and alpha helix is a building block of tertiary structure. So I threw you a little bit of a curveball right there. Okay. I used alpha helix as a building block. I didn't ask you what the building block of that alpha helix was. Okay. So make sure you can go up and down. Here is a deoxyribonucleotide, hydroxyl group, glycerol, carbonyl group, a ribonucleotide, right, that makes RNA, sulfhydryl group, amino group, that's all pretty easy now, a carboxyl group, inorganic phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid. Oh, we've done this already. Okay, we're done. Hopefully you didn't get motion sickness. Okay, now where would you find something like this? All right, so all of these pictures are in your textbook, I do believe. I don't think I got another source for them anywhere. But where is the video? Where's the video located at? Okay. All right, so this is where I can close the window down. Cursor, right here, close window, nice. All right, so we want to go to the internet, in particular Blackboard. Here's the announcements page. Here is somebody's physiology class, 10347. And if we go into exam study guides, does anybody see that? Exam study guides, one in one. Exam study guides. Hopefully I'm going in the right direction. Okay, exam study guides. And we look down over here. So we're going to look for exam number one. And then you're going to have to scroll a little bit down here, T1 exam videos. And here is the chemical structure flash quiz for you. Now, if you want to watch this thing, this is a very generic kind of video format, WMV. And it will play in Windows Media Player pretty well. right? But it won't stream off the server very well. So what I recommend you do when you get to this link right here is right-click it, and it's going to ask you what to do, and you want to save it on your hard drive someplace. So save link as, save target as, make a folder, a 241 folder on your computer, download it to your hard drive, and it's a fairly large file. Let me just put it, where should I put it? I guess I'll put it in fall so I kind of know where it is. All right, I'll save it. It's downloading. We're really fast right here, so it's already downloaded. Oh, it's only 4 megabytes. That's not too bad. Okay, so when you find it in your folder, should we go find it in that folder? Okay, what it was, 15. Here it is right here. Flash quiz. I think that's it. Okay, right click once again, and hopefully it will say open with. Open with and. You could say play. Chances are if you have a PC, it's going to play in Windows Media Player. Sometimes that works pretty well. Sometimes you see the video, but you don't get the audio. Sometimes you get the audio and you don't see the video. And if you want to mess around with Windows Media Player updating and that kind of stuff, you're welcome to do that. But there's an easier thing to do, and that is to download the VLC Media Player. And it has always worked for me and for every student. You can even run VLC with Firefox on a Apple machine. I don't know if it works very well with Safari, but with Firefox it does, and you can run Firefox. So I would open it with VLC, and okay, I don't know about all this other kind of stuff. Da-da-da-da. And I hired an actor to sound just like me. So you can turn the sound off if you want, and this just goes through all the slides that we've been looking at so far. Okay, so you should be able to really just, what's that? Yeah, so say it before I say it. What's that? So here, and then if you want to check the spelling, you can check the spelling. All right, so this first time through is kind of slow, and then I speed it up in different repetitions so that you'll be able to look at these things hundreds of times before the test. Oh, what's that? That's a nucleotide. Yes, okay. That's enough of that. So, it is in Blackboard. Download it to your hard drive by right-clicking. Play it in VLC by right-clicking once again, by open with, or you could actually you could designate VLC as your primary video player if you want. That's not a bad option. All right, so that's how you would do that. Any questions on that? Okay, so I probably won't show you that again in class. All right, where was our Blackboard class? Right here. So what other videos do you have? Nernst equation calculation. We're going to get into that maybe in this chapter, okay, in chapter 6. And then here is a video on pH calculation. I had some questions. Well, how do you calculate pH if we were to give you some numbers, right? Or how do you calculate the hydrogen ion concentration if you're given pH? So here are a couple videos. But I think I just dragged out my calculator and did it. But probably, maybe we should do that right now. You didn't bring your calculators to class, but if you did, that would be great. I don't know if you did or not. All right, so I'm going to go to something here, like the DocCam, Display 2 DocCam, and I'm going to fumble around and see if I can actually calculate these things. Aha, that's going to be really boring. All right, so pH. First, just generally tell me, what is a pH a measure of? The hydrogen ion concentration or acidity, either one of those are perfect, right? And the pH number is a little strange because as the acidity increases in a solution, what happens to the pH number? It goes down, right? The smaller the pH number is, the more acidic it is. So if I was going to draw I am going to draw a beaker right here. Right. I'm going to draw three beakers, like so, and like so. And I don't think that was me playing that. I think I turned my media player off. Somebody is maybe playing that. Okay, so here we have beakers with water in them. Right. And what is a hydrogen ion? Let's start there. What is a hydrogen ion? It's a proton. Yes, a proton without its electron. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people just call them protons. You could call it a proton if you want. So tell me which, and it's going to be abbreviated, just H plus. Right. Tell me which beaker that I have right here is the most acidic. Okay, and I've got to let me draw all of these, like so. Okay, which beaker is the most acidic? 1, 2, or 3? 3, because it has more hydrogen ions, right? So as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, the acidity increases. So this is most acidic. And here is least acidic of these three beakers. All right, and now tell me something about this beaker, but I'm not done drawing it just yet. I didn't mention this in our last lecture, but you can tell me something about the pH in this beaker right here. Okay, and somebody said 7, and I would like to know how you saw that. Why do you know it's pH 7? Okay, somebody said neutral. I like neutral, right? And pH 7, that means that the hydrogen ion concentration has got to be equal to the hydroxide ion concentration, right? So it's the same, no matter what it is. So this is pH 7. pH 7. pH 7 is absolutely neutral. If it's less than 7, what does that mean? Acidity is going up. If it's more than 7, it is basic. All right, so you get a sense of that. Acidity increases, pH number goes down. Now, why is that? That's because of that fancy equation that we use. Okay, so I can erase this. I don't think I need any other examples of this thing right here. All right, so the pH number is equal to, this is usually how we write it out, minus the log of the hydrogen ion concentration. And if we put little brackets right here, that is just the usual form for saying concentration of. And that's in moles per liter, and it could be a very small number, which, in which case we have to use scientific notation. And if it is pH 7, the hydrogen ion concentration is 1 times 10 to the minus 7, like that. Okay. And then if we put that in here, then we would get a pH of 7 because there's that minus 7. And what does that minus 7 mean? Oh, wow, I haven't done this in a long time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is that right? Is that what that means? So it's way too difficult to write out all the time, so we use scientific notation. How's that? People kind of following that pretty well? All right. So there is maybe, so there's a number of different ways that you can calculate this. It just so happens because this is a log, and remember this is log to the base 10. You might have a different log, another log button on your calculator, which is ln, a natural log. Right, to get rid of this negative sign, what we can do is just put log of the, and that's to the base 10, of the hydrogen ion concentration, but the inverse of it. The inverse of the hydrogen ion concentration. And then you don't have to use that minus sign. So this is typically the one that I use. I don't know what I used in the video, but let's use my calculator right now. And I'll give you a hydrogen ion concentration of 1.5 times 10 to the minus 7 molar. All right, so I don't know if you can tell if that's acidic or basic right now. So let's calculate what it is. All right, so here is my calculator. Can you see my calculator? All right, so we got 1.5, right? That's easy, 1.5. Could you see what I was doing there? Not really, too fast. Okay, so the lights are shiny. They're too shiny. If I tilt it a little bit. Then I need a pencil or something. Aha. Okay, here is my cell phone. You cannot use your cell phone on the test. Okay, but I'm going to use it just to make it so that you can see the keyboard. So I want to type in 1.5, right? So 1.5. Oh, I got this wrong. 1.5. Okay, and you can't correct each other's work either on the test. That's too bad. All right, so 1.5, but we want 10 to the minus 7. Right, so I need an EE function, and I see an EE function right here. That means I'm going to go to scientific notation. Right, so EE, and you see these little zeros that pop up right here? That means 10 to whatever those numbers are. And we want a minus 7 in there. There may be a couple different ways to do that, but I'm going to hit plus minus to put a, because right now it's a plus, right? So I'm going to hit plus minus, put a minus right there, and then what's the number? On that 10 that's on the board? 7. All right, so I'm going to put a 7 right here. 1.5 times 10 to the minus 7. That's what it looks like on my calculator. Everybody else's calculator is going to look a little bit different, so you got to practice to know what the sequence of buttons is. All right, so let's do the bottom equation. So what do we do with that? This is the hydrogen ion concentration. All right, so here we are right here. How do we get to this thing before we take the log of it? Inverse, we need to take the inverse of it. So where is that inverse button? I see it right here. 1 over x. So 1.5 times 10 to the minus 7 is going to be x when we push that button. And it's going to be a funny number, and we don't care what it is. Okay, I don't care what that number is, because now what do we do to find the pH? So we've taken the inverse of the hydrogen ion concentration, inputted it in scientific notation, then we're going to take the log of that number. And guess what that gives us? The pH. All right, ready? And so the log we want is this one here. That's log. The one that you don't want is over here. Right next to each other. So be careful. Log. All right, and the number is 6.8, blah, 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 but you could just consider that 6.8. So is that acidic or basic? It's a little bit acidic, right, because it has to be 7 to be neutral. And does that sort of make sense? Well, if this was 1.0 times 10 to the minus 7, that would be pH 7. That would be absolutely neutral. But this is 1.5, which means what? There's a little bit more hydrogen ions in there than 1, right? So that means that it's a little bit acidic, and that's what that number turned out to be, 6.8. All right, so did you write that down? Write that down so that you can practice 1.5, 6.8, pretty much the same. All right, well, if this is the pH, it would be a really good idea for you to be able to calculate the hydrogen ion concentration. How on earth are you going to calculate hydrogen ion concentration? Well, we need to put this to an exponential of power of 10, and I have a nice exponential power 10 button. Okay, and right here. I don't know, can you see that? 10 to the X right there, all right? But that 10 to the X is probably a fancy color, so I have to go second, right, to get to that function. Second, right, 10 to the X is that number right there, okay? But now we have to take the inverse of that number, and that is what? 1 over X, like that. And is that what we started with? Yeah, it is, but not in scientific notation. I can't see these letters well enough to go to scientific notation, but if we count the decimal places, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Okay. How do we get to scientific notation? Okay, does somebody see how I get to scientific notation? I can't see. All right, I'm going to have to work on that. I don't want to spend too much class time looking at that. All right, so if you have a question, you can also use the video to work with your calculator, and everybody's calculator is different. Maybe a lot of people have this kind of calculator, maybe not, I'm not sure, but during the exam, can you share calculators? You cannot. And can you use your cell phone? Cell phones can do this really nicely, but you cannot, right? So make sure you have your calculator and you're familiar with how to use it. And the Nernst equation that we're going to learn pretty soon, you'll use the calculator in a very similar way with a log function. All right? Okay. All right, so who's got a question? Anybody got a question? Maybe during office hours, you can come see me and we can work some pH problems backwards and forwards and figure out how your calculator works. All right? Okay. That's not too bad. But it will be really helpful because then you'll have a much better understanding of what pH is all about. Oh, good. I thought I lost the computer display. I didn't. All right. So here's pH calculation from hydrogen ion concentration. Here is hydrogen ion concentration calculation from pH, going backwards and forwards. And how would you, what's the preferred way for watching this video? So here's the link to that video. Oh, now this is an AVI, not a WMV, but you know what? VLC doesn't care. It's happy. All right. So right click, save link as, save target as, something like that. Put it in your 241 folder and then you can play it. When you have it on your folder, then right click once again and say open with VLC player. That will do it. Okay. I'm pretty happy with that. Unless somebody has a question. Questions? So, no? Not too bad so far? Let's see. Scientific non-graphing calculator. This is true. Okay. If somebody wants to borrow my calculator, that probably would be okay. Right. Yeah. So math department requires scientific non-graphing calculators. Okay. Borrow one from a friend or something, or mine. Okay. And probably even if there's 20 students in here and you want to borrow my calculator, that's fine because you're only going to use a calculator for a minute or so. Right. You just have to know what buttons to push on it. So you might want to come by my office and practice with my calculator if that is the case. All right. So let's take a look at the schedule. We're going to move into Chapter 6 today. Are you ready for Chapter 6? Okay, let's get started with Chapter 6. And Chapter 6 is right here. Pointer options, arrow options, visible. I'm going to show it on both screens. So 1 and 1 works like this. And we're all set up with the lights. Okay, so we're going to look at interactions between cells, and we're going to look at the extracellular environment. What is the extracellular environment as opposed to the intracellular environment? What's extracellular? All the stuff outside the cell. Right, okay. All right, so extracellular environment includes all constituents of the body outside of cells, and we can break the extracellular environment down into a couple components, right? But intracellular compartment is almost 70% of your total body water is inside cells, right? 30% of all your total body water is outside the cell, or maybe 33% if we're going to be a little bit more precise, is in that extracellular fluid, or ECF. And we can then break down ECF into a couple compartments, and that is interstitial fluid. Interstitial fluid is fluid between the cells, and it's contained in a gel-like matrix, especially in connective tissue that we call ground substance. It's a protein modified with the sugar, and it acts like a sponge, and it holds a lot of water. So of that extracellular fluid, 80% of it is in between cells. The remainder, which is 20%, is blood plasma, right? And blood plasma is, well, the major component right there is water. Now, what kind of connective tissue is plasma? What kind of connective tissue is plasma? Anybody remember? What kind of tissue did I ask? What kind of tissue is blood? Sorry, what kind of tissue is blood? Yeah, it's a connective tissue. Sorry, I got my questions mixed up. So it's a connective tissue.
And the space between red blood cells and white blood cells, right, in that connective tissue is called what? What do we call that space between cells in a connective tissue? The name is matrix, right? The matrix is that space between cells in a connective tissue. And that space, that matrix in blood, right, is plasma. And that holds 20% of the extracellular water that's in our body. All right, let's look at this interstitial fluid. It says it's contained in gel-like matrix. And that, where did we find a matrix again? What kind of tissue has a matrix? Connective tissue, right? And remember that matrix has a couple components. It can be fibers, right? Or it can be something else. I mentioned it just a little while ago. So water is not contained in fibers. You should probably know the fibers, collagen, elastic, and reticular fibers. All right, and what's that other component that makes up a matrix in a connective tissue called? This gel-like substance. That was a hint. Gel-like substance, it's called ground substance, right? Ground substance is that part of the matrix that doesn't have fibers in it, and that's what holds 80% of the extracellular fluid. And so that's kind of where they got these terms from. Gel-like matrix, you could call that ground substance if you're going to use the formal understanding of what's in a connective tissue. And plasma is just, you could think of that as like being the ground substance in blood, because blood is a connective tissue. Okay. All right. So where is that extracellular matrix at? So here we have a nice blood vessel. Here we have a nice epithelium. Oh, who can tell me what kind of epithelium this is right here? Yeah, it's a nice simple, and it kind of looks cuboidal. You know, maybe if you look around a little bit different views, you can see it's a squamous, but to me it looks like a simple cuboidal. And then we have a nice basement membrane, and that helps attach this epithelium to underlying structures. And in this particular case, it's going to be a connective tissue. And I see a fibroblast here, here, and here, and some collagen fibers. So this looks like an areolar type connective tissue, which is a loose connective tissue. It has a lot of ground substance and a few fibers. And so fluid can leave this kind of blood vessel and go into the extracellular space. And what kind of blood vessel is this going to be? You can tell by the shape, but also by the function. I see arrows leaving. It's a capillary, yeah. So functionally, this has to be a capillary. That's only where exchange takes place. So the water part inside plasma can leak out into the matrix. And this ground substance is a proteoglycan, which is a protein that's been modified with a sugar molecule. And it acts like a sponge to hold all of that water. These things are all held together with special proteins within the membrane called integrins. And the purpose of this connective tissue is just to hold all of these items together, like the epithelium, helps attach the epithelium to underlying structures, right, including this blood vessel right here. Okay, that's the extracellular matrix in a connective tissue. Thought I had something else to say, but I don't with this one, unless I come back.
So if the connective tissue part is the extracellular part,
This plasma right here, it is still extracellular because it's not inside a cell. So this plasma, this water that helps make up plasma, is what? 20% of extracellular fluid. 80% is going to be interstitial fluid, which is the fluid between these cells. And in a connective tissue, these cells are far apart, so it can hold a lot of water within the matrix. The fibers don't hold water. Collagen, elastic, reticular fibers don't hold water, but ground substance does. Right, so I see some fibers right here, and space between the fibers is that ground substance, that proteoglycan that absorbs a lot of water. Okay, and because it absorbs a lot of water, this almost acts like a solution. Things can move around through ground substance. It can diffuse through ground substance. Right, but it doesn't slosh around like water. Okay, so that's the beauty of it. All right, so how do things move around? And we're going to start looking at how do things move around through a plasma membrane. All right, so
what the heck is a plasma membrane and what's the building block? We look at the building block of membrane. What is the building block of a membrane? It's a phospholipid, right? And we said that those things just self-assemble each other. And the way that you think about a plasma membrane is that it's a phospholipid bilayer. It's a phospholipid bilayer. And the phosphate groups are pointing either to the extracellular fluid or to the intracellular fluid, in which case it's water. And the hydrophobic tails are pointing to the interior of the membrane. And I think we could probably draw that out pretty fast. So how would we draw a phospholipid bilayer? Really quickly. Okay, so here is some inorganic phosphates. Here are the hydrophobic tails. So this is a single layer, but we said that a membrane is a bilayer. How would that arrange itself up against this first layer that we drew? What's going to be attracted to these hydrophobic tails? Other hydrophobic tails. All right, so here we have another layer of phospholipids, like this, like that. So it's a bilayer. That's basically how membranes are put together. That's a very rudimentary idea of a membrane, because other things can be put into a membrane to change its structure, to change its function. And what does anybody remember from anatomy? What's the model that we use in our mind to understand this phospholipid bilayer when other things have been added to it to change its function? It's a special model. It's called the fluid mosaic model. The fluid part of that model is the phospholipid bilayer. The mosaic designation means that other proteins and other lipids can be added to the membrane, changing its structure. And when the structure is changed, what can you tell me about the membrane? The function of that membrane changes as well. Okay. That's going to be in the cellular chapter when we get to it. This plasma membrane is selectively permeable. It allows only certain molecules to pass through. In general, there are some molecules that cannot ever get through it. Right. What is this interior part? Give me some physical chemistry properties of this interior part of a plasma membrane. Okay, nonpolar. Exactly right, nonpolar, which means it's hydrophobic. All right. So since it's nonpolar, any kind of polar molecule will not move across. It will be excluded. It will be contained on one side of the membrane or the other. What kind of molecules can move through this membrane freely? Hydrophobic, right, or nonpolar molecules, because it can move through this plasma membrane. All right, that was the reason why we wanted to know something about polarity. Plasma membrane, selectively permeable, only allows certain kinds of molecules to pass. Most easily would be hydrophobic molecules or nonpolar. And if it is a polar molecule or one that likes to dissolve in water, then there has to be something special added to the membrane to allow for that kind of transport. And here are a couple ways. Carrier-mediated transport involves a specific protein as a transporter. And the molecule being transported has to bind to the protein before it is transported. And then there are non-carrier-mediated transports. And so it could be a tunnel or a channel, and that polar molecule can diffuse and move through that channel across the membrane. So the phospholipid bilayer will be separated, and that there's going to be a channel between across the membrane. And then that transport through that tunnel can happen by diffusion. Okay? And diffusion means something is going to move from high concentration to low concentration all by itself. All right, so let's talk about diffusion a little bit. Transport processes can either require energy or not require energy. If they require energy, we say it is active transport. If it doesn't require energy, it is passive transport. And diffusion is a really good example of passive transport. Compounds that move down a concentration gradient require no energy to do so. Okay, because that is diffusion. So diffusion is a form of passive transport. And so what would be a really good example of diffusion? Well, for instance, if I'm standing here with a perfume bottle and there's no perfume, that particular perfume in the room, and I open the bottle, that perfume is going to evaporate into the air. So it's going to be high concentration by the bottle, and it's going to be low concentration in the class. So what's going to happen to that perfume molecule? It's going to move from where I am to where the concentration is lower, which is basically everywhere in the room. It's going to diffuse out. And who's going to smell it first? People in the front row. Who's going to smell it after that? Second, then third, then fourth, right? And so that perfume molecule is going to move from high concentration to low concentration. And if we close the doors and go away for Labor Day weekend and come back on Monday, what can you tell me about that perfume molecule in the front of the room compared to all the way in the back of the room? It's going to be the same, right? It's going to equalize over a long period of time. And when the concentration of perfume in the front of the room is the same in the back, is any diffusion taking place? And you should see and understand that no, diffusion stops when there is no concentration gradient, right? So perfume won't build up in one corner of the room to a high concentration all by itself. It will only go from high to low concentration. And when the concentration gradient or difference in concentration in a room goes away, then diffusion stops. And it doesn't require any energy. And things can diffuse through a gas, things can diffuse through a liquid, it can diffuse through water, not just air. Active transport moves compounds up their concentration gradient or against their concentration gradient, but that requires energy. And in a cell membrane, sometimes we call those things transporters that will actually allow a compound to move across the membrane. And there has to be an energy source associated with it. What's a very common energy source inside cells? ATP, that's right. So ATP will drive active transport, a special kind of active transport, and we're going to call that primary active transport if ATP is used. All right, so who can see diffusion pretty well? Can anybody see diffusion, how that works from high concentration to low concentration? All right, well, maybe I'll give you just another example because this is a pretty important concept. Okay. Versus active and passive and how you're going to remember that. All right, so pH has got to go away. All right, so here's the car that I had when I was in college. It was an MGB, okay, and it was about that big. Little four-cylinder car, very, very light, very, very old. It was made in Great Britain, which doesn't build very reliable products, right? So I never knew if this car was going to start when I got in it. Sometimes the battery was dead, sometimes the starter motor was dead, and all other kinds of things could be wrong with it. So what would I do with this car when I stopped it so that I knew that I could go home, like after school or work? Well, I would park it on top of a hill. Right? I would always park it on a hill, and then if I couldn't start the motor with my ignition key, all I had to do, because it was a manual transmission, I could put it in first gear, just give it a little kick, because it was a really easy car to push around, and would it go down the hill without the engine on? Would it roll down the hill without the engine? Yeah, because you don't need gas to roll down a hill. Right? And then I'd pop the clutch, and I would start the engine, and I could drive home. So that was really, really nice. All right, so what kind of mechanism is this? So we're going to call this high. We're going to call this low. So going from high to low, is that active or passive? From high to low is passive. I don't need that engine running. I don't need that engine going. I don't need gasoline. It's just going to happen automatically. All right, so high to low is passive. All right, now what about this car down over here? And it's going to go, can it ever go up the hill? Not all by itself, but it can. If I have gasoline, if I burn gasoline, it can go up the hill. So from low to high is what we call an active transport process. And in us, with the gasoline, mostly it's ATP. We're going to learn about some other things. All right, so from high concentration to low, that is passive. And can you give me a name of a passive process? That this illustration here doesn't demonstrate it, but The name of a passive process that we're interested in terms of cellular transport is?
Diffusion.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so I expect everybody to get passive motion or diffusion always correct on a test. High concentration to low concentration. Especially if you had a car like I did in college. Yeah, question.
Under the active transport, you have to power energy and transporter.
Mm-hmm.
So then what are the transporters?
Transporters will be proteins that are embedded in the membrane. And I erased the membrane, so they're going to be special proteins embedded in the membrane, and they're going to have access to one side of the membrane and the other, but not usually both at the same time. You've got some pretty good pictures in your book regarding that. All right, so to understand the rest of this discussion, we got to know what a solution is. I don't think your book talks about it, but it's a really good something to know. A solution has two components. It has solvent and a solute. Right, and so let's work with some of these questions. Have you used a solvent today? Have you used a solvent today? Think about something that maybe has these two components to it. So what solutes have you used today? Well, I tell you what, maybe we got to go back to solvent. Okay, what kind of solvent did you use today?
Water.
Yeah, like water. And what did you use that water for? You just drank it. Yeah, okay. That's great, but that might be a little boring. Okay, what could we do to that water? Yeah, we could make tea out of it, right? So we're going to take a tea bag, and some of those particles in the tea bag are going to diffuse into the water. So now you have water plus tea particles. The water is the solvent, and the tea particles are the solute, right? So what solutes have you used today? Coffee, sugar, cream, tea, that kind of stuff. What is the major solvent in your body? Is going to be water, that's right. What are some important solutes in your body? Proteins, sodium, potassium, glucose, all of these things that can dissolve in water. As a matter of fact, what's the nature of all those compounds that can be solutes in your body if water is the major solvent? They're going to be, polar. Somebody thought polar, that's good. Or hydrophilic compounds, right? Here is something strange. What's a minor solvent in your body? So water is the major one, but there is one more, and it's kind of minuscule. It is? Well, blood has water in it, so it's still water is the solvent. Okay? This is kind of strange, so I just got to tell you. Fat. Fat is another kind of solvent, or oils. And what kind of compounds can dissolve in oils? Hydrophobic compounds. And there are some what we call water insoluble vitamins or fat soluble vitamins, and guess where they are stored in your body? In fat, right? So you do have fat stores which can store other kinds of hydrophobic kinds of molecules. And as a matter of fact, we just drew a membrane on the board, and what is the interior of that membrane? It is hydrophobic, right? It is oily, so other kinds of oily substances or nonpolar compounds can dissolve inside that membrane as well. All right. So what can dissolve in this minor solvent? Hydrophobic molecules. All right. And maybe give an example.
Well, I can think of one. What about cholesterol? What kind of compound? Is it a sugar, a protein, or what? Nucleic acid, it's a lipid, okay? So cholesterol is a lipid. It's a hydrophobic compound, and it can dissolve very easily in that inner compartment of a membrane, right, or the hydrophobic part of the membrane. So you could say cholesterol. And indeed it does, and cholesterol is used to help increase the rigidity of cell membranes, makes it a little bit stronger, and it can dissolve in there really, really nice. All right, so here is a nice example of molecular diffusion. And here we have a beaker, and there's two sides to this beaker, and these particles right here represent solute, and we can pick any kind of solute. And which side has a higher concentration of solute? Is it going to be the left or the right? The left. I see a whole lot more particles on the left compared to the right. And so
if we remove this barrier all of a sudden and we don't have to stir it up, we don't have to do anything, what's going to happen to all these solute molecules on the left? They're going to move to the right, and we don't have to stir anything up because that process is diffusion, and it will go always from high concentration to low concentration. And then if we come back after the weekend, we're going to notice that the particles density on the left is going to be the same on the right, or we could say the concentration is the same on the right and left. And when there is equal concentration, what can you tell me about diffusion? It stops because it needs a gradient, right, from high concentration to low. Right, so there's no net diffusion. There will be solute molecules that move from right to left, but it's going to be exactly the same number that move from left to right. And so we say no net diffusion, right? If so, if we look at in both directions, there is no net change in concentration within this beaker. Okay. Nonpolar compounds really diffuse through a cell membrane. Okay, so that's a statement, but you should understand why. Why is it that nonpolar compounds can diffuse through a cell membrane while polar compounds generally cannot? Let's start with this one. Nonpolar. Why can nonpolar compounds move through a cell membrane? Nonpolar. Because the cell membrane itself is nonpolar on the inside, right? Phospholipid bilayer. So anything that's nonpolar can move through a cell membrane because the essential nature of a membrane is nonpolar on the inside. Okay, there are also some small molecules like CO2, okay, can move through a cell membrane. And for water, there usually has to be a channel or some kind of protein in there, but carbon dioxide is kind of sneaky. It can just move across the cell membrane by itself. So gas exchange occurs in your body by diffusion. All right, so think of, here's a cell inside your body. And what is the concentration of oxygen inside the cell that's inside your body? Think about, now the cell needs oxygen. We haven't studied why, but the cell needs oxygen to make ATP. So what is the concentration of oxygen inside the cell? Okay, and it's kind of tricky to see this, but you're right. The concentration of oxygen is low inside the cell, and in the air around us, the concentration of oxygen is high. And can oxygen move from high concentration to low concentration all by itself? That is nice, right? So oxygen is going to have a tendency to diffuse into our cells, right, all by itself, because, and that's really handy because our cells need oxygen, in particular mitochondria, to make ATP. So that is handy, right? Oxygen will diffuse in our body, and that is a nice passive process. Right, and then mitochondria make ATP with this oxygen. The mitochondria make carbon dioxide. So carbon, that's another gas. Carbon dioxide builds up inside the cell. And there is some carbon dioxide in the air around us, but it's almost zero. Right, so what is the concentration of carbon dioxide inside the cell compared to the air? Well, I said air is almost zero. So carbon dioxide inside the cell is high. Almost zero in the air, so which way is carbon dioxide going to diffuse? Outside our bodies, and that is really helpful, right? If those concentrations weren't like that, then we'd have to develop all different kinds of mechanisms to move oxygen inside our cells and move CO2 out of our cells, and it would require energy to do that, right? So we get oxygen in, CO2 out in a fairly inexpensive way because diffusion is driving that process. All right. Well, here we have a nice cell membrane, right? You see a phospholipid bilayer right here? Phospholipid bilayer. And I see some other proteins that are embedded in the membrane. This is a nice integral protein. It expands. It goes all the way across the membrane. And this is a channel. Channels sometimes can be closed, and they can be open sometimes, right? And so here is a molecule, right? And we're going to just call these ions. Ions, what can you tell me about an ion? It has an electrical charge on it, right? So things that have an electrical charge, are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Things with a charge. Hydrophilic, charge compounds are hydrophilic. What can you tell me about this inner part of the membrane? Hydrophobic, so hydrophilic molecules cannot just readily diffuse across the membrane. right? They need this channel in order to do so. So if you have an ion at high concentration outside the cell, low inside, these ions want to get inside the cell, but they can't because of this hydrophobic barrier that's keeping them out. So here is a protein that will allow these ions to move through, right, to the inside of the cell, going down a concentration gradient from high to low. So this would be an example of diffusion, right, through this channel. And the cell has the ability to open and close channels depending on its needs or if it's trying to communicate with something. Right? So channels don't have to be open all the time or closed all the time. They can be changed depending on certain conditions inside the cell. Okay? So, and sometimes we might want to call this, well, this is a good example of what we call a gated channel, which means that sometimes it's open, sometimes it's closed. All right, so what determines the rate of diffusion? How fast is diffusion operating? It's directly related to something and inversely related to something else. So when we say directly related, what does that mean? So we have an equal sign. If something increases on one side of an equation, what happens on the other side? It increases as well, right? That's what we mean by directly related. Inversely related, if something increases, what happens on the other side? It decreases. Right, just like that pH equation. So the magnitude of the concentration gradient controls the rate of diffusion. And as the concentration gradient gets larger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? Since it's directly related, it gets faster, right? If the permeability of the membrane increases, what happens to diffusion across that membrane? Then it increases. Temperature, if we increase temperature, what happens to the rate of diffusion? Increases, and if we increase the surface area or the doorway for exchange, it also increases the rate of diffusion, right? So all of these things increase the rate, all right? And then this next one, the one that's inversely related is molecular weight, and that is just how big and heavy a molecule is, and that's fairly intuitive. As the molecule gets bigger and heavier, then the rate of diffusion decreases because it's just harder to move around, okay? All right, so that's something, and you'll work with that in lab. Here is an interesting term, osmosis. Right, and there are three criteria necessary that have to be fulfilled before we consider a process osmosis. All right, so let's talk about it, and then we'll see what those criteria are. Here we have another fancy beaker with a membrane separating out two compartments. And then let's zoom in to this area right here and take a special look at this membrane and also the solution on either side. So when I zoom in, I see that this membrane right here has pores in it or channels. Do you see these holes in the membrane? Okay, and the solution has some large particles, we're going to call these solutes, and then it has some smaller ones, we're going to call that water. And it just so happens in this particular case, water is smaller. And if we look at the diameter of the water particle compared to this pore inside the membrane, this water molecule can fit through it. Right? Can you see that it fits through? All right. But now look at the size of the solute. It cannot get through this pore because why? It's just too large, right? So this membrane will allow water to move across it, but not the solute. How is water going to move? Okay, through this little pore right here, the membrane is allowing it to go through. How is it going to move if it's going to move at all? It's going to move from high concentration to low, right? And that doesn't require energy. That's what we call diffusion, right? So this water molecule will diffuse all by itself from left to right. And when is the diffusion of this water molecule going to stop? When the concentration is the same on either side. Yep. But right now I can see a higher concentration of water right now. And here we have that solute. The solute concentration is higher on the right than on the left, so it's dying to get across, but can it? It cannot because there's no pathway for it to go. So this concentration gradient is maintained with this solute particle. If a solute particle cannot get through the membrane, we say it is osmotically active. And we're going to have to work with that concept a little bit. It maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense right at the moment, but just remember that for later on. This particle is osmotically active if it can't get through the cell membrane. Okay, so here are two criteria for, actually all the criteria for osmosis. What is diffusing? So osmosis is diffusion. Okay, what particle is diffusing?
Water.
Water, right? So for osmosis, it has to be the solvent molecule, and in us, since we're interested in us in this class, what is the solvent molecule in us? It is water, right? So for osmosis, it has to be water, and it's moving. And how is it moving? What kind of process? Active or passive? A passive process that we call diffusion. So osmosis is the diffusion of water, but there's one more important criteria. It's got to diffuse through this little barrier right here. And how would we describe this barrier? Semi-permeable or selectively permeable. So osmosis is the diffusion of water, right, through a selectively permeable membrane. Right, so if you know that, that's good, but you should really understand, all those terms are kind of loaded. You got to know what diffusion is. You got to know what the selectively permeable membrane is, right? A selectively permeable membrane means that there has to be osmotically active molecules on either side of that membrane. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this. This is sort of interesting. Here we have a chamber, once again, with a selectively permeable membrane between it, and we have different concentrations of glucose in these two different chambers. Right, we have 180 grams per liter of glucose in the left, 360 in the right. So which one has a higher concentration of glucose? The one on the right. Which one has a higher concentration of water? The one on the left has a higher concentration of water, right? So all of these things have to add up to 100%. If there's more solutes on the left, there is less water. If there's less solutes if there's more solutes on the right, there's less water. If there are less solutes on the left, then there's more water on the left, okay? Because all of these things have to add up to zero. So if water concentration is higher on the left than it is on the right, which way is water going to diffuse? From high concentration to low concentration, right? So the molecule we're looking at right here are not these dots, but actually the water particle, because what process are we interested in describing here? Osmosis, and that is the water molecule, not the solute. Okay. So we let water diffuse across, right? And the diffusion of water is going to stop when the concentration of water is the same on either side of the membrane. But as a water particle moves into the right-hand side chamber, it increases the volume of the chamber on the right-hand side. And more water is going to move across, the volume is going to increase, right? And it's going to apply a pressure to this membrane. And it's going to force the membrane right to the left. Right? And when is diffusion going to stop? When the concentration is the same on either side of the membrane. It just so happens then that the concentration of glucose will be the same. Water can move through cell membranes if they have special channels. Those channels are what we call aquaporins. Typically, water can't move across a cell membrane because it is polar, right? And think what kind of particles can move through a membrane? Nonpolar, right? So in order for water to get across this membrane, there has to be aquaporins in it. All right. Well, we might say, you know, let's push this membrane back to where it was. How much force is required to push this membrane back where it was? And that's what we call osmotic pressure. All right, so when osmosis takes place, that can produce an osmotic pressure. So the force preventing a change in volume is what we call osmotic pressure. Here we have a beaker of pure water on one side and less water on the other because there's some glucose in there. Which way does water want to go? From high concentration to low. So it's 100% in the left-hand chamber. It's less than 100 on the right. So water is going to move over into the right-hand side chamber, and that's going to push this membrane back. But if we hold it, right, we have to exert some pressure, and that's what we call osmotic pressure. Cell membranes are very pliable. They're not very strong. Osmotic pressure can easily change, right, the size of a cell or the shape of a membrane. Okay, and I think what I want to talk about right now, and I'm going to come back to these next time, right, is something called tonicity. So here are three possible conditions. Tonicity is the effect of a solution on the osmotic movement of water. And what is that? Just the diffusion of water. So let me draw this on the board. We're going to draw some more beakers. And so we got three beakers. Like so, and we're going to put a red blood cell in there. And it just so happens that this red blood cell has a selectively permeable membrane. It won't let solutes through, but it will allow water to go through. And so what's the concentration of water inside these cells? I got to remember what it is. Does anybody have an idea? I think it's like 0.98%. Okay, so 0.98% water. What's the solute concentration? 0.02% solute. All right. And so we're just going to put 0.02% solute here, 0.02% solute right there. Okay, so that's solute. And let's put pure water right here, 100% water. And over here, we're going to make this, okay, 0.98% water. Right? Or, and I'll draw it, I'll just jot it down, 0.2% solute. And over here, let's put some seawater. All right, and let's just say that seawater is 0.1% salt or solute. What's the concentration of water in this beaker right here if it's 0.1? Yeah, 0.99%. Okay. Okay, so if we start with this beaker, where is water at a higher concentration? Inside or outside the cell? Outside the cell. There are aquaporins in this particular membrane. Which way is the water molecule going to move? Or is it going to move at all? It's going to move inside the cell. Okay, it's going to increase the volume of that cell. The cell is going to expand, right? Just like that beaker did. All right, now here, right, if it's 0.02% solute inside the cell, what is the water concentration? 0.98. So where is water at a higher concentration, outside the cell or inside the cell? 0.98 outside, 0.98 inside. So the concentration is the same. Which way is water going to move? Not going to move one way or the other, right? No net diffusion. What's going to happen to the shape of the cell? It's going to stay the same. The volume is not going to change. Let's see if I got this right. Okay, now over here, okay, what is the water concentration here? Yeah, so we got what, 0.98? Did I do that right? Yeah, that looks pretty good. Okay, so here we got water. Here we got water. All right, so where is there a higher concentration of water? Inside or outside the cell? Inside the cell, so which way is water going to go? It's going to go out, right? And it can diffuse out. The solute cannot get across this membrane, right? So is this an example of osmosis? So what has to happen for osmosis? Down a concentration gradient from 0.98 to 0.9? And it has to be the water molecule or the solvent molecule. Is that right? Is it the solvent molecule? It is. And is this a selectively permeable membrane? You're going to say yes, because the solute can't diffuse across it. So would this be an example of osmosis? Indeed it is, right? And this is an example of osmosis as well. All right, so no net diffusion. We want to name this solution right here. We're going to call this isotonic. Isotonic, and it preserves the shape of the cell. So if you're going to be getting an injection of something, do you think it would be a good idea to have that solution that's injected into you isotonic? So it doesn't change the shape of those cells, especially red blood cells. Okay. All right, now what about what's happening here? All right, so we see water going into the cell, and the cell's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. The cell membrane is not strong enough to withstand that pressure. It's going to burst, right? And it's going to happen fairly quickly. The bursting of that cell is called hemolysis. Right, when it bursts. And when it bursts, you can't get that cell back. It just blows up. Sounds pretty drastic. All right, what's going to happen to this cell right here? It's going to shrink down. Right? It's going to shrink down. It's going to lose some water. We call this crenation. All right, so this is just isotonic solution. It doesn't crenate nor hemolyze these particular cells. All right, so what kind of solution causes hemolysis and what kind of solution causes crenation? We have to know this. Okay, so we can have hypertonic or hypotonic. Okay, so the hypertonic solution causes crenation. The hypotonic solution causes hemolysis. And isotonic doesn't change the shape of the cell one way or the other. Okay. This is irreversible. You can't bring the cell back. This condition is reversible. If there are cells that are crenated, how do you get them back to their original size, their size that they should be? You take these cells and put them in a isotonic solution, and then the water will balance out to exactly what it should be. Okay? All right, so that's the importance of knowing tonicity of various solutions. If somebody drowns in a pool or a bathtub, what's going to happen to their cells? Are they going to crenate or are they going to hemolyze if somebody drowns in their bathtub? What's the concentration of water that's coming out of your faucet? It's basically 100%. Okay, so if somebody drowns in pure water, that water is going to go inside these cells and hemolyze those cells that are in your lung. Okay, if somebody drowns in the ocean, what's going to happen to those cells? They're going to shrivel up. They're not going to hemolyze, right? So that salt that's in their lungs from salt water is going to cause crenation of those cells. Right? So it's really easy to tell. For instance, when somebody drowns. So if somebody drowns in their bathtub, okay, maybe somebody holds their head underwater, for instance, and they drown, and then they take that body and throw it in the ocean, and they say, oh, you know, this person drowned in the ocean. Would somebody be able to tell? Yeah, because they get this person from the ocean, and what happened to the cells? They're all gone, and it's just really obvious that right, that person didn't drown in the ocean. Right, that they got into the ocean after the fact. All right, so what time do we go to in here? 12:45? Okay, so we're going to go back and look at molarity and molality next time and take a look at this picture right here. And this one directly relates to the discussion we just had with tonicity.